Hey guys, this is Jeff with EMS Hooligans. I had the day off from work, and I'm actually sitting here alone because my family went down to Kentucky without me. They left me here all by myself, but good news, that means I can do my podcast without babies yelling at me. I wanted to take the opportunity, being kid-free and wife-free, to talk to you about something I think is important. Something we don't talk about much is Scarbosa criteria. What that is our mechanism for deciding STEMI criteria in the presence of a bundle branch block. It's not overly confusing or hard, but it does sound that way. Puts a lot of people off because of it. The first thing we need to know is the trifascicular system. That's just a fancy way to say there are three parts of our bundle branch system sitting in our heart. We have the right side, or right-sided bundle branch, which consists of one fascicle. You probably saw this in anatomy in paramedic school. The left side is bifascicular, which means it bifurcates into two different places. These consist of an anterior and a posterior portion. Those put together consist of our bundle branch system. So why does that matter? Why do we care about this? Well, the mortality on bundle branches, or bundle branch blocks, is actually significantly higher than someone without one. We used to think bundle branch blocks didn't really have any clinical significance, especially pre-hospital. But as an example, a posterior bundle branch block with AMI symptoms actually carries an 80% mortality. Now that's a big number. If you think about it, I mean, that's huge. And knowing this going in could really be the difference between really helping one of your patients or kind of letting them circling the drain and not knowing what's going on. Someone with a single bundle branch block, for example, carries a 4 times higher mortality than somebody without and greatly increases the chance of multiple heart blocks occurring. As well, someone with a bifascicular block actually carries an 8 times mortality higher than someone without. What a bifascicular block is any two blocks occurring at the same time, meaning a first degree and a right bundle branch block, a left-sided bundle branch block with anterior and posterior involvement. I think with that information, it's pretty easy to see why we've decided that this carries a high clinical significance now, and why Scarbosa criteria has become more popular and more talked about. Keep in mind that a posterior left-sided bundle branch block still is the most deadly of the ones you can get. Another aspect to think about is, one, this can affect your treatment plans. Knowing somebody has a bundle branch block and how severe it is and where it's located at. And we'll talk about that more in depth in a little bit. Number two, we're trying to stem misdiagnosis. As a new provider, it's very easy to misdiagnose a bundle branch block as a STEMI, because when we learn to diagnose STEMIs, we look at the J point. When a bundle branch block, the J point can be elevated as well, and we have this knee-jerk reaction of not only activating for a STEMI, but treating it in the field. And this can be very detrimental to our patients, which we'll delve into more in a little bit. But for example, I used to work in a system that gave heparin in the field. Now imagine I activated for a STEMI and gave a heparin protocol in the field with somebody who didn't have anything wrong except they had an old bundle branch block. And that could be very detrimental to my patient for really no reason. So where do we see the J points occur? The J point junction sits just after the QRS complex, and in a healthy patient, it'll sit at the isoelectric line. It's right before the positive or negative deflection in your T waves. However, in a patient with an MI or a bundle branch block, you'll see elevation or depression, so that you'll have real J point elevation or depression, but in the presence of a bundle branch block, it's kind of a false positive. Keep in mind, too, outside of bundle branch blocks, if you see depression in an EKG, remember it's nonspecific, and you should do a 15 or an 18 lead to determine right-sided and posterior involvement. So how do we know if somebody's suffering from a bundle branch block? A typical QRS complex is 40 milliseconds or 80 milliseconds, depending on which version of which book you read, to 120 milliseconds. It's important to note that a QRS complex greater than 120 milliseconds is actually how we classify a bundle branch block, and we will look for this in V1. As well, a QR, QRS complex greater than 170 milliseconds is actually a very serious bundle branch block and carries some weight to it as well. QRS complexes greater than 170 milliseconds typically have an ejection fraction less than 50. Now, if you think a typical ejection fraction is 60 to 75, a healthy ejection fraction is 60 to 75%. 50 or less is pretty serious. In the presence of a bundle branch block with a QRS greater than 170, there's a significant risk for precipitous drop in blood pressure secondary to nitrate use. This is due to our compensatory mechanisms. You get systemic vasoconstriction, which in turn causes an increase in afterload to account for the lowered ejection fraction. So what does that actually mean? When you use nitrates with this, you're gonna bottom these people out. Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't use nitrates, but I'd have a large bore IV on board and give some fluids as well, or at least have them hanging. The next thing we need to talk about for you to have a good understanding of what's going on is how to determine the direction of a bundle branch block and its axis deviation. So first, how do we determine the direction of a bundle branch block? It's not very difficult. Find your J point, the point just after your QRS complex where it will typically sit at the isoelectric line, but it's probably going to be elevated in these patients. Circle the J point in V1 and then draw a line backwards from your J point through your QRS complex. Now fill in the complex from the line you just drew to the tip of your QRS. If you have a QRS complex that's both positive and negative, use the biggest one. This is called the turn signal method because if you have a mostly positive QRS complex, then it's right-sided. When you use the indicator on a car and want to turn right, the indicator goes up. And the opposite is true as well. If your QRS complex is mostly negative, then you have a left-sided bundle branch block. Just like if you were turning left, the indicator would go down. Next, if you have left-sided involvement, you need to determine if it's anterior or posterior, because we know posterior involvement carries a huge mortality, 80%, and we need to determine the position of our bundle branch blocks using axis deviation. There are two ways to determine axis deviation. The easier of the two is looking at the P, QRS, and T axis provided in your 12-lead EKG. The problem with this is if you have to force your EKG because you have noisy data, you're not actually going to get that number. So it's important to know both ways. In a typical EKG, a typical 12-lead that you can actually look at these numbers on, look at the QRS number, and that's your axis deviation. Now that we have that number, we need to determine what those numbers mean. A normal axis is 0 to 90 degrees. A physiologic left axis is 0 to negative 40 degrees. This stems from people just being overly obese or even their positioning can cause a physiologic change. Typically, we don't pay this much mind. A pathological left axis can also be seen in pregnant women, so keep that in mind if you're looking for bundle branches as well. But a pathological left axis is negative 40 to negative 90 degrees. This means that in the presence of a left bundle branch block, we have an anterior blockage. Although less severe than a posterior blockage, it is still serious, but you'll see it much more common, thankfully, than a posterior. A right axis deviation of 90 to 180 degrees means we have very serious posterior blockage in the presence of a left bundle branch block. It's more serious because a posterior blockage is intrinsically bifascicular, which means there's multiple blockages because it blocks both the anterior and posterior fascicle. An extreme right axis deviation, also known as ERAD, is probable VTAC. You'll see this at negative 90 to a negative 180. Although there are other things that you need to constitute VTAC, this is a pretty pertinent finding and should clue you in to look further. We'll talk about that on another date, but you really shouldn't be diagnosing VTAC with a pulse without a 12-lead. Keep in mind, rabbit ears in your QRS complex may or may not be there, but does not actually constitute a bundle branch block necessarily. What people say is that rabbit ears anywhere in your EKG means they're suffering from a bundle branch block. They think this because you'll see in this presence ventricular repolarization at different times, creating a longer QRS complex, hence the rabbit ears or the ventricles repolarizing. The problem is sometimes the QRS created is not long enough to constitute a bundle branch block, because we know a bundle branch block has to be greater than 120 milliseconds in V1. Sometimes you won't see them at all either with your bundle branch blocks, although it is a common occurrence. The second way to determine axis deviation is to look at leads 1, 2, and 3. In a normal axis, the QRS complexes will all be positive. In a pathological left axis, lead 1 will be positive, and leads 2 and 3 will be negative. So that means there's an anterior blockage. In a right axis, the QRS of leads 1 will be negative, and leads 2 and 3 will be positive. That means there's a posterior blockage. In extreme right axis deviation, leads 1, 2, and 3 will all be negative. And again, this should clue you in that they very well could be in VTAC. I realize that can sound confusing just listening to it, but if you take the time to write it down or look it up and print it off and put it in your ambulances, determining location and bundle branch blocks will become much easier. When I was on a 911 truck, I used to hang these signs up for my own use so I didn't have to remember so much. If you've taken hand heavy or you've really kind of delved into thinking at all, you know there's two subcategories of our thought process. Type 1 and type 2. So let's talk about type 1 and type 2 thinking for a second. Type 1 thinking is classified as our intuitive thinking ability. It's reflex thinking and only consists of things we've truly ingrained in our heads. Typically, these are tasks or systems that you don't have to put any thought process into doing. Type 2 thinking is complex. We use type 2 thinking in our high acuity patients. This consists of doing complex math or thinking of probable outcomes from our interventions. What we want to do is limit our type 2 thinking as much as we can to lessen our workload and ability to make errors that we shouldn't have. Hanging up pictures means you don't have to completely remember them and limit your need for complex type 2 thinking. And it limits your ability to make mistakes that you shouldn't have made. So let's talk about what Scarboza criteria actually consists of now that we have a good working foundation to decide if someone has or doesn't have a bundle branch block. There are three specific criteria we use to determine if someone has positive findings for a STEMI using Scarboza criteria. The first question we ask is, does my bundle branch block have ST segment elevation 1 millimeter or greater that's concordant with my QRS axis? Concordance means that my QRS and ST elevation are going the same direction. They're both positive. This carries a high chance that the person suffering from this has an active STEMI as well. The next question we ask is, does my bundle branch block have ST segment depression greater than 1 millimeter in V1, V2, and V3? This carries a moderate chance that the person suffering from this has an active STEMI. The final question we have to ask is, does my bundle branch block have discordant ST elevation greater than 5 millimeters? Discordance means that the QRS complex and ST elevation are going opposite directions, one's positive, one's negative. This carries a low chance that the person is suffering from an active STEMI, but the chance is still there. If you don't have these findings, then the likelihood is pretty slim, not impossible, but probably not there. And it's probably an old bundle branch block. These three questions are easily remembered and will help you see the severity of your patients suffering from bundle branch blocks, but you can also write them down for easier use. There's some other important things I want you to know as well, just kind of wrapping up here. If you have someone suffering from a bifascicular blockage, you may see a sudden change in the patient's condition and the development of a complete heart block, as this risk significantly rises in the presence of a bifascicular block. Don't be horribly surprised if that happens. You should also carefully weigh the use of antiarrhythmics in the presence of a bifascicular blockage. Antiarrhythmics slow conduction pathways and may even cause a drug-induced complete heart block or asystole. If you think it's necessary to give one, Just keep in mind there is a risk that comes from it. As well, you may have heard someone tell you at some point, if an antiarrhythmic doesn't work, try a different one. That's a dangerous practice. I'm not entirely sure why people say that, but I've heard it myself a few times as well. This should really be avoided, as the benefit won't outweigh the risk. The truth is, using multiple antiarrhythmics is actually pro-arrhythmic and will increase your chances of ectopy. Right bundle branch blocks are the least concerning bundle branch blocks that occur. Next would be a left bundle branch block with an anterior blockage, although it does carry a 4x mortality than somebody without one. And the most lethal are left bundle branch blocks with a posterior blockage, as this is intrinsically a bifascicular block and carry an 8x or 80% mortality in the presence of an AMI. Bundle branch blocks can be transient due to ischemic tissue, so you may see them resolve themselves, or they can be permanent from dead tissue. Hopefully I've made this a little bit easier to understand. If you like this podcast, please like and follow us at EMS Hooligans on Facebook and Twitter, or on our website at emshooligans.com.